Welcome to Little Atoms on Resonance 104.4 FM, a live talk show based around ideas of the Enlightenment.
Little Atoms is presented by Neil Denny, Padraic Reedy, Richard Saunderson, and Rebecca Watson, as well as regular mystery guest presenters.
Little Atoms makes no claims to balance. We actively promote science, freedom of expression, skepticism, and secular humanism. This means we can often end up talking about superstition, religious fundamentalism, censorship, and conspiracy theory.
Our guests bring ideas that are challenging, sometimes controversial, often polemical, but always interesting. I'm Neil Denny, and you're about to listen to a hastily cobbled together best of compilation of bits and pieces from Little Atoms during 2010. So coming up, we've got Rebecca Watson and myself interviewing Professor Brian Cox, myself and guest host Adam Rutherford interviewing Ian McEwan, then Rebecca and me talk to Dara O'Brien backstage at the big libel gig, then Padraic Reedy and myself talk to Lynn Barber. This is followed by Rebecca Watson and myself talking to Cory Doctorow, and then a couple of interviews that I recorded on my own with Timothy Garton Ash and Rebecca Skloot. To finish off, we've got a couple of interviews from this year's TAM London. First of all, Rebecca and I talked to Jonathan Ross backstage, and finally, myself and guest host Josie Long interviewing Alan Moore on stage. Have a great Christmas and a Happy New Year, and we'll see you in 2011.
Hi, good evening. Welcome to the first Little Atoms of 2010. Tonight with me, Neil Denny, and with Rebecca Watson. And before we actually get into the show properly, our last show before Christmas, our Nine Lessons and Carols special, has caused something of a complaint. So basically, Rebecca's going to talk about this first of all.
That's right. Thank you, Neil. We do take these things very seriously because here in Little Atoms we do try to strive for journalistic integrity and scientific integrity as well. So we take email responses very seriously. So after our last show, this email came to us from Jim. Jim writes, "The interview about the LHC was unfortunately what one would expect from a high school student trying to get by without research. Circulating kittens is not possible, since you have to use charged particles. It's all magnetic steering and acceleration. It is a very uninformed and dumb question." Of course, Jim was referring there to our interview with Brian Cox, in which we discussed the Large Hadron Collider and whether or not one could stick two kittens inside the collider and what would then happen. So we didn't realize at the time that it's not, in fact, possible to accelerate two kittens to the appropriate speed. And for that reason, we'd like to apologize and also to correct the record by having Professor Brian Cox on the show today to discuss the LHC, any plans or research he might have done on a large kitten collider, and any other science that he's currently working on. So welcome to the show, Professor Brian Cox.
Thank you. I think Jim's been a bit pedantic there, because you can charge a kitten by rubbing it on your jeans. You know, it's not too difficult to charge a kitten. The problem with a kitten is that they're quite massive. There are too many protons in. So I think he's just actually, he's focused on the wrong thing.
Right.
I could accept, you can charge a kitten up to really very high potential, actually, by connecting it to a plug socket, if it's appropriately earthed. And, you know, it'd be fine.
Have you actually done any hands-on experiments with that sort of thing?
I wouldn't put my hands on the damn thing if it was charged up to a million volts. I'd leave it to prickle. But, I thought you said we were going to talk about serious science here.
Oh, let's
talk
are.
About, yeah, after that we've got over the, yeah.
We have some other questions.
He's focusing on the wrong thing. Okay. It's the mass of the kitten that I objected to, if you remember.
That's true.
Rather than the neutral nature of it.
Well, thank you for putting the record straight, Brian.
Ian, thanks very much for speaking to Little Atoms.
A real pleasure.
We're here to talk about Solar, your new book, so perhaps you could briefly tell us first of all what it's about.
Well, it's about a sort of fat-lying bastard of a physicist who won the Nobel Prize back in the mid-80s. I have to be very careful to be vague about this date, because some physicists do win the prize every year, who is a sort of philandering, greedy, lying, rather deceitful man. The background noise to solar is really climate change, climate science. It's the story of a man who starts out vaguely sceptical or generally uninterested, bored by climate science and climate change politics, but who, through a series of accidents, becomes involved, steals another man's ideas, and finally tries to bring to life a prototype of an artificial photosynthesis plant in the deserts of New Mexico, at which point all his previous indiscretions and lies catch up with him, and the whole thing disintegrates at that very point.
So, well, let's jump straight into something that's been mentioned a lot in the coverage already, is the fact that you took part in this Cape Farewell trip, which is, there's a central sequence in the book where Michael Beard goes to the Arctic and with a number of artists. So tell us how that influenced you, basically, to write the book.
Well, it was a very beautiful place, and I spent a week there with a number of artists. I mean, some disreputable elements of the press, and I won't mention the Sunday Times, have tried to make out that I've used solar to skewer or pour scorn on an artist, but in fact the one artist on that trip who comes out badly is the only novelist on the ship, whom Beard destroys. The novelist suggests that Heisenberg's uncertainty principle paves the way to moral relativism, and Beard takes great exception to this. I used the trip really to distort and change into my own account, and what happens in my novels got very little to do with what happened on that trip, except that we did have a lot of passionate and interesting and quite hilarious debates sometimes about climate change and about the world that we wish to put to rights. And meanwhile, on the other side of the bulkhead was a kit room, a changing room, rather dark, obscure, cramped, where we had to keep changing in and out of all this gear we'd been issued with. And it gradually became more and more chaotic. And one idea I came away with and wrote about the following week for The Guardian was that there was a sort of comedy about our immediate aspirations and ambitions when we talk in grand terms, and the close-up chaos that can spill around us. So that it was, I don't know, I can't say it was the beginning of this novel, it was just one thought I had in a notebook. I spent some time at a climate change conference in the same year, actually, Potsdam. I knew John Schoenberger, who's Angela Merkel's chief scientific advisor, and he invited me really to be a sort of after-dinner mint. They were very weighty individuals, all Nobel Prize winners. So I spent some time in the company of 30 scientists, mostly mathematicians, economists, physicists, who had won Nobel Prizes. And the collective frisson of so many powerful egos made me think, at that point, if I ever get round to this novel, I'm awarding right now a Nobel Prize to its central character. But really, the novel was driven by its character. I mean, it was a character that were my first thoughts. He sort of loomed in the mist, got fatter and badder, as it were, as the book unfolded, and I found myself heaping more and more faults on him.
It's interesting that you describe him as a fat bastard. I mean, he really is a shit. And the inevitable question that follows on from that, which I'm sure everyone will ask you, is how closely is it based on, well, not necessarily an individual, but you've just described a whole set of prize winners and the egos that they displayed. So is Beard an amalgam of...
There's no kind of key to this. There are... I mean, I dread... Someone did say, oh, there is a physicist down in Neyman University who resembles your character. So I Googled this name, Google Images, and to my relief, he's rather thin. It looked remotely what I had in mind. So I think I'm safe. I take comfort in the fact that, when Flaubert published Madame Bovary, I think there were about 40 local chemists, pharmacists, who started actions against Flaubert, and there's safety in numbers, I mean, it's self-counseling. But no, he has no origins in any person or amalgams of persons. I should have actually put a disclaimer in front of this book. It seemed to me too obvious to want to do. But I'm not saying that all of humanity are shits, nor am I saying all scientists are shits. But I'm simply saying that we are a great mix of things, and that we are extremely clever, and there are ways of being stupid that only very clever people can seem to attain. And I took no pleasure in this, but I thought that what happened to Copenhagen at the end of last year was very much in the spirit of Michael Beard. You know, cleverness in the form of science that assembled 192 nations, and atavistic impulses in the form of national self-interest and tribalism destroyed the meeting. That's why at the end of the book I made sure I invited Beard to attend.
And in a sense, I felt that it was somewhat of an indictment of this sort of higher echelon of scientists, these very senior figures with Nobel Prizes who sort of coast along at the end of their careers, being invited onto, well, being invited onto onto boats with artists and novelists.
Well, actually, the oldest scientist I know is Jim Watson, and he's no slouch. I mean, he might say things that upset people now and then. So, you know, I can't honestly say that all Nobel Prize winners just coast along. It's in the nature of science that probably best work is done in youth, and the grant applications, etc., and the budgets and funds and boring administration science is done, but also all the influences extended by older men and women. That also is appealing to me. There's a sort of inbuilt tragedy to a science Nobel Prize. It's never going to be work that you're just about to do or did last week.
So in some senses you're very, very science literate and you get invited along to these things, and many scientists, the fact that the two of us are interviewing you now, as a novelist you have great scientific literacy and you get invited to these same sort of forums with beard-like characters. Possibly. And
well, that's what happens. I mean, you pay the penalty if you invite me to your conferences, then.
You must pay the price.
So what about the younger character? What about Tom Aldous? You don't meet so many of them.
No, I don't. Well, my son was a postdoc for 4 years in Glasgow, and I met some of his colleagues. None of them had ponytails. None of them were called Mike. None of them had coloured string around their wrists. But I just devolved a kind of fantasy about them. Such kids, and like the idea that an older man would be completely paranoid about them because they were talking too fast, they interrupted each other, they were deep into regions of mathematics that he struggles to keep up with. That is the anxiety of age, you know, that the young are running too fast for you.
One of the other parts of the book that there's been a lot of sort of critical attention about in the reviews that so far is in the second section of the book where Beard makes an unjudicious throwaway comment about women in science and he loses his position. And it's been mentioned a number of times that this sort of parallels what happened to Larry Summers at Harvard. Yeah. And in fact, in the Guardian review, stated that he sort of thought that wouldn't happen in England. It was more of an American thing. But it immediately made me think of, you've just mentioned James Watson, who was the person before Larry Summers immediately jumped out to me as someone who must have influenced that part of the book.
He did, actually. Jim Watson's always saying outrageous things. He once said that stupidity was an illness, and one day science and medicine would cure it. He got quite a beating up for that. But he made, you know, some remarks about race and the whole place, you know, a sort of self-pleasuring ecstasy of indignation. And being indignant was, I sometimes worry that being indignant has almost replaced sex as a sort of main pleasure for sections of the community. Was it the Natural History Museum immediately said he was not allowed to speak there and universities closed their doors to him and everyone was instead of just engaging with the thing, it spirals of... So, that was part of it too. My own experience of occasional press storm, close friends have been through it. So one way or another, I had enough background in this to really just want to have a gentle tease about the nature of the British press. Its curious, kind of screechy, hysterical, partisan, inaccurate, intrusive qualities.
Joining us now is Dara O'Brien. Dara, thanks for sitting down with us.
It's a pleasure. It's an absolute delight, yes, in this rarefied environment where the same posse of people who turn up at all these nerd gigs seem to be appearing. It's actually getting a little bit comfortable now at this stage. I think it's probably time that we tore ourselves apart and expose the rifts that exist. Yeah, I think so, actually. I think what should happen is that we should all, whether it's me or, you know, Minchin or Goldacre or Singh, should all desperately struggle to try to be the one with the high ground. And then it should just rip itself apart in a series of one-upmanships.
Or just a drunken fistfight or something.
Yeah, but like an ideological drunken fistfight where we all feel that we've given more to the cause. Now, I haven't given anything really to the cause. I do the odd gag here and there. So I don't know what I'm going to do to Trump. I'm involved in a massively ruinous libel case. Two of them can do that. Minchin isn't wearing shoes, so he's already got that angle. So it's difficult to know where I'm going to come in.
I believe you are the only one wearing a velvet jacket.
I am, because I'm in show business. And when you're working in show business, it is, as the name implies, the business of show. So people, it's still a stage out there, there's still lights, microphones, you know, you still got to put on a, you know, the ordinary public would like to think that those of us who live in the gilded cage will occasionally slip on a bit of velvet and just make an effort.
Mm-hmm. Well, we've mentioned a couple of times in earlier interviews that although we're here tonight to, the issue was the Simon Singh case, which is where this all started, really. Yes. But, of course, all of this stuff overflows into show business as well. So, I mean, do you find, you know, when you're writing material, do you find yourself self-censoring because of these sort of issues?
No, you generally don't because you generally, I mean, you... For making very, very specific allegations. No one has yet, as far as I remember, I think Alexei Sayle said something, but there have been very, very few libel cases taken against a comedian. I think people regard as being, in Britain anyway, bad form. And show that, you know, you can call me whatever you want, but don't say I haven't got a sense of humour. So we actually have been given a pretty free run of it so far. I mean, I think if you do something substantive like he did, point out something that, you know, people have been trading off, then yeah, perhaps. But like, no, I've you know, the Gillian McKeith routine, you know, that went out in a number of different formats and fonts. And all the time I kept hearing about her husband was a libel lawyer. So you kind of go, well, that's surely... If we haven't heard by now, then no. If you don't. I mean, there's so many other things you're worried about. Is it funny? Will the audience like it? Will they get it? Will they understand? All these kind of things. You're kind of going. It's rarely been an issue with somebody.
But what about? I mean, say for something like Mock the Week, for instance. I mean, clearly, you know, something that's going out on the television. There must be, and you know, there has been a chilling effect over the BBC over the last.
Well, the chilling effect. The chilling effect on the BBC wasn't necessarily to do with libel. Was to do with them. Ross and Brand and
sure.
The Daily Mail and those kind of campaigns, but that does have an effect. But there are always lawyers at shows like ours. I mean, we do them. We don't do them live for a reason. When stuff is broadcast like that, I think people have less of a sense of humour about it. But there's always been a disclaimer: don't mention brand names or products and stuff. That's always existed. So it's not like that. You know, it would be. I'm not sure necessarily. Listen, nobody's here saying that there shouldn't be a libel law. Nobody's saying that you shouldn't be able to say what you want, that you should have completely carte blanche to insult people in whatever way you want. We're just saying that the ruinous cost of it led to it becoming a tool for bullying.
And you say that people don't generally go after comedians, but didn't you recently run afoul of some blasphemy?
Oh, yeah, that's sweet, actually, because I only a few days ago found that I'd been cleared of blasphemy in Ireland because I insulted a tree stump. That apparently represents the Virgin Mary. That was, you know, a huge relief to myself and my family who'd been living under the yoke of perhaps not getting into heaven, because I went on television and pointed out that it actually looked like a collection of isobars, is what I said. It looked like a bun, I said.
Did you apologise to the tree stump?
No, I haven't. And it wasn't, you know, the tree stump's feelings aren't known on this. The case was taken on its behalf by somebody who said that I'd shown a tremendous lack of understanding of the Second Coming. Literally, this was his argument, that I hadn't properly respected the second arrival of Jesus and the signs that had been left around. Mm. And it'd be like, he said, as if I'd describe Garden of Gethsemane as being a silly old park. That was the actual words he said. It was something I now insist on doing.
I mean, it's famous that the swings were rubbish.
Well, it was a very poor park, the Garden of Gethsemane. For one thing, you'd bring your children there to play, and there'd be three men hanging off crosses, like, and it just kind of ruined the atmosphere.
It's kind of a downer.
It is. You know the way when you go into a public park and there's some teenagers, you know, maybe drinking cider or something, or maybe people, you know, there's a fire, you know, where they'd be all gathered around, and you know, and it looks like scruffy. These are three guys who took 3 days to die. That's not, you know, that in a park.
Health and safety would never allow that sort of thing to happen.
Not a happy place to be. What's wrong with them?
Now, in Ireland, the blasphemy laws have recently been big news. How do you feel about them?
I have a gamble at the moment with a well-known Irish chanteuse that the first one to get done on the blasphemy will buy the other a bag of chips. That is how I'm regarding it. I am regarding it as a prize, a €25,000 fine for blasphemy in Ireland. At some stage, I'm hoping that it will be presented to me mid-show by the police, who will come out with a giant rubber check like Telethon. And see, and the point, I don't actually have a blasphemous routine. I don't have a thing that I want to do. But there is a very silly ending to my show, this tour. But there's an even sillier version, because in Ireland, not only do I do the silly thing, but then I blaspheme during the silly thing. And you're kind of going, well, how can I make this more ridiculous? How can I, you know, I can't dance around and blaspheme any more than I already am. It's patently ludicrous. But most Irish people don't even know it's there. And no one asked for it. But it's great. So.
Well, I certainly hope you win the bag of...
Thank you very much. I'm really, really looking forward to the 25,000. I don't know what I'll spend it on. Oh, we'll have a holiday first, and then we'll see what we're going to do.
Dara, to finish off, we've been inviting everybody to libel somebody else that's on the bill, just to get into the spirit of the evening. So,
Ed Byrne killed a man once with a pool cue, and it was a bar fight that he got into over, you know, and it was over nothing. And the guy wasn't even the guy who's playing. It was just another guy was looking at him, and Ed was losing, and Ed went, what? And the guy said, nothing, I'm here with my wife. And so Ed beat him to death. And we don't go on about it a lot, you know, but and the guy, you know, he didn't need this. He was a nice guy, like. But so he did that. Ben Golaker disposed of the body. He buried it in lime, and then Tim Minchin danced on the grave barefoot and composed a beat poem about the whole incident.
It sounds like this must have been at a previous nerd get together.
I think it was either the Amazing Meeting or one of Nerd Stocks. Where we get together. You know when the nerds get together and it kind of kicks off, and before you know it, there's a dead guy, and then there's a hooker crying, and then there was a lot of coke, and it was a hell of a night. You know, it was, you know, for a Tuesday, it really kicked off.
Well, I can't wait to see what this night brings. Thank you very much.
Pleasure. Dara.
Thanks, Dara. So let's talk about how you basically became, you know, Demon Barber, the terror of Fleet Street. Let's talk about the early days on sort of Fleet Street, and how you actually began to become an interviewer.
Well, actually, I did interviews before that for Penthouse a bit, and that was a very good training in a way, because we had this section called, I think it was called Parameters of Sexuality or The Wilder Shores of Love, which was about people's sort of sexual kinks. And it was very good practice, because I would interview somebody and they would just be described as a foot fetishist or a dominatrix or a sex change man or whatever. So they were anonymous, and they were keen to talk. I mean, I think they actually volunteered to be interviewed. Mm-hmm. So all I had to do was basically just sort of sit there and get it out of them. So it wasn't difficult, but...
So this would have been the early 70s?
Yes, absolutely, or even the late 60s, mm-hmm. slightly. And what that trained me, well, was never to be embarrassed, you know, and to work on the assumption that people wanted to tell me things rather than that they didn't want me to tell me things, and never to sort of show shock or disgust. So, you know, just keep it coming sort of thing. So that was quite good. Then I took some time off to have children, and then I went back to the Sunday Express to do a regular back-of-the-book celebrity interview called Things I Wish I'd Known at 18, which just meant to doing some random lots of celebs week after week after week, and it's one of those things where it's all one quote from them, so you don't actually intervene at all. But that was quite valuable because they all tended to say the same things, the emphasis had to be on thinking, picking up any minor difference, you know, from the other people, as it were. And I got particularly keen on capturing their real mode of speech rather than their sort of idiosyncrasies of speech, and that again was quite good. And then I don't know, I just did more and more interviews, and then the big breakthrough was that the Sunday Express sent me to interview Bob Guccione, who I'd worked for all those years. And in those days, you were meant to write interviews as third-person pieces. But I thought, well, I've got to say I work for him. It's crazy. I mean, you can't sort of understand what we're talking about unless you have that background. And so I wrote in the first person, and it was very, very good. And, I mean, it's still very readable. And from that point on, they had to let me just write them as I wanted, you know.
Before we move on and talk more about that, I just wanted to step back a second because, you know, you mentioned that you work for Penthouse. And from a distance, from where we are now, that seems like an interesting idea. And not because you once worked for what would perhaps be considered a pornographic magazine, but just the very idea that in the 70s there were pornographic magazines that had writers working for them. So, you know,
so
Playboy would be, you know, would be publishing stories, you know, centrefolds next to a short story by Huntress Thompson or Norman Mailer
We were imitators of Playboy, and that was the great Playboy formula, that, you know, you have it so that a man could buy it and sort of say, I'm buying this for the short story by Ernest Hemingway or the interview with Gore Vidal, you know, and we also operated on that basis. The word content was quite high, you know, there was a lot of it, but also it was quite, it was pitched quite high, it wasn't stupid. And also, the other thing is, I mean, I suppose it was a porn magazine, but I mean, if you looked at it today, you wouldn't think it was a porn magazine.
No, sure, but those things do obviously change anyway. But what's interesting is that seems unthinkable nowadays. If you look at, you know, there were magazines in the supermarket, like the likes of, like, Nuts or something, which isn't a pornographic magazine, but it's probably, you know, as pornographic as Penthouse was at the time you were writing it. And the idea that they would have literary content in there whatsoever is...
Oh, no, but you see, you're thinking in terms of the lads' mags, and there weren't lads. There weren't lads' mags.
No, sure, but that's the way it's gone.
Lads,
they were gentlemen.
You're the gentleman in your fine penthouse, you know, lying in your Eames armchair, flicking through this rather fine magazine with its interesting.
By contrast, I think your description of the penthouse club.
Oh, yes, that was miserable.
Absolutely abysmal. Yes. That was far from Ian's chairs and, you know.
I know, that was an absolute hellhole. And tragic for me, because I had to take clients to lunch there. And all my authors, who I've been used to taking to nice restaurants, I said, they had to take this horrible, horrible penthouse club. It was a really gloomy place, actually. Maybe at 3 o'clock in the morning it cheered up. It was terrible.
Or your expectations were just lowered so much by that point. But it's still a fantastically readable interview, and you've got this set of, I mean, obviously, you with Bob Guccione, you had, you know, access that no one else could really have had. But is there, it seems a bit of a truism to say, but is there an extent today, I mean, I've just been reading mostly men, and the willingness to talk in the interviews then seems very different.
Well, yes, I mean, certainly in those days, particularly mostly men, a lot of which are from my Sunday Express days, so from the 80s, right, you certainly didn't have PRs around the place. And I mean, now you actually have PRs sort of insisting on sitting in on the interviews. And then, you know, I recently interviewed Liam Gallagher, and there was all this palaver. You can only talk about his clothes line, and you've only got 45 minutes. I mean, in fact, it was fine, you know, but that none of that happened in those days. But I think I am quite good at getting people keen to talk, as it were, and to get them on side with my line being sort of, I'm really trying to understand you and why you did this, and then they will sort of help, as it were.
Cory Doctorow, thank you very much for joining us on Little Adams.
My pleasure.
We are sitting in a remarkable office full of kitsch and steampunk, and it looks like everything you've collected over the past 30 years.
Everything I've kept out of everything I've collected over the last 30 years, that's right.
Right. Do you feel that surrounding yourself with such creative stuff helps you in your writing process?
I guess so, a little bit. I always love those old Ray Bradbury Presents
TV shows where they open it with a shot of his office and the dinosaurs and rocket ship. I'm Ray Bradbury, master of imagination, you know, and you'd see him typing away at, you know, his paleo typewriter. And yeah, physical culture is, you know, if you're going to write about technology, having a lot of technology around, which, you know, I take a very broad view and include things like books as technology. You know, I have that piano roll up there that's the, you know, the first ever contested digital file format that led to the first big copyright fight, you know, in the early part of the 20th century in America, and John Philip Sousa saying the infernal talking machines would rob Americans of their voice boxes as monkeys lost their tails when they came out of the trees and so on. So yeah, I like having this stuff around. It's kind of, some of it's like a memento mori, like a poet keeping a skull on his desk, you know? And some of it's inspiration too, like those 3D printed math sculptures there that came on top of that hollow book that I keep my office supplies in. And then there's sorry, I'm getting away from your mic. But these are museum replicas that were 3D printed at the Royal Ontario Museum in Toronto. So they were scanned and printed from their collection in epoxy. That's amazing. Pretty cool.
Oh, our listeners can't see these things, unfortunately.
Yeah, well,
we'll take pictures.
And then there's this, which is also a very telling artifact. That's a 200,000-year-old axe head. And the interesting thing about it is the shop that I bought it in also had 300,000-year-old axe heads that looked just the same. So there was a period of 100,000 years during which the state of the art didn't budge, right? I mean, that to me is actually one of the most important technological lessons that you can learn, is that what we think of as the inevitable progress actually doesn't necessarily always take place.
But the real question is, was there a price difference?
I don't remember. Maybe there must have been. I think they had them in a lot of different sizes, which weren't specific to the era. They just, I guess, people who made axe heads 300,000 years ago used whatever was lying around. And I think I picked that one because it would fit in my suitcase.
Well, obviously, technology advances a little faster these days.
Uh-huh.
And we were just talking on the way, and particularly in reference to Little Brother, and you just mentioned that you write about technology. Does it matter to you in that writing process that technology inevitably dates? So stuff that you're writing about now will be, especially the subject matter you write about, will be obsolete within a couple of years?
Yeah, no, not at all, because I'm not trying to predict the future. I think at best I'm trying to predict the present, which is to say I'm trying to use the device of futurism to tell stories about how technology today is invisibly and pervasively changing society and vice versa. And, you know, I think the easiest way to do that is to have that device, is to have that funhouse mirror. You know, I don't think Mary Shelley was upset that, you know, no one ever figured out how to animate dead people. I think that, you know, her science fiction stands up very well as a cautionary tale about what happens when technology becomes your master instead of your servant, much more than it would have done if she tried to accurately gauge where the future of, you know, lightning-animated dead people was going, you know.
So I've been joined by Timothy Garton-Ash. Tim, thank you very much for speaking to Little Atoms today.
It's a pleasure to be here.
You're a self-described liberal, and liberal is a term which is, well, it's pretty much a mortal insult in the States. But let's talk about your own version of liberalism. What does it mean to you?
For me, it's a word we have to defend against the absurd perversion of the term in American usage, where it means some sort of godless communist, the friend of big government and, you know, unprotected sex. I mean, it is one of the great semantic tragedies of our time, that this great word, I mean, what is the United States if not in its core liberal country, has perverted this word. What does it mean? I am a lifelong liberal in the sense of John Stuart Mill, Gladstone, Isaiah Berlin, I would say George Orwell, and it means that individual liberty is your highest political value, that for you is the most important thing in politics. And then the question becomes, how is it best defended? I'm a modern, in many ways egalitarian liberal. That's to say, I don't believe that, as some classical liberals would say, the beggar is in principle free to dine at the Ritz. He isn't. So this means effective freedom. So I believe in education, I believe in basic health care, I believe in a basic income guarantee, but all for the purpose of achieving the greatest possible freedom of the individual.
As you've already mentioned, I mean, America is, I mean, its founding fathers based the country on that principle, and, you know, it is the, really, possibly, you know, the only truly liberal country based on those founding principles. So why do you think the term has become so traduced over the years?
Well, it's very interesting. You can follow it through, and it starts in the 60s and 70s with a kind of, so much of American politics is a kind of about a cultural revolution of the 60s and then a cultural counter-revolution. And it's in that period, 60s, 70s, 80s, into Reagan and then into the neocons, that it becomes, I think, in many ways quite deliberately, to be caricatured as this defense of big government and socialism, as they say, of Obama's healthcare reform and so on, so that even Obama, who is clearly a liberal, does not dare to use the term. I mean, I say this in the book, I have an essay about this, I'm saying maybe in his second term he'll dare to use the word. In substance, his ideas are clearly those of a liberal, but he prefers to say progressive, a word which here and there, I think, means absolutely nothing at all.
But of course, people are already saying not only, you know, he's a communist, he's a, you know, he's a secret Muslim. So if he says the word liberal, they're going to hear communist, aren't they?
I think, you know, there are some words that it's actually not worth fighting for. For example, if I believe, which I don't particularly, in a liberal version of multiculturalism, I don't feel the word multiculturalism is worth fighting for. Let's say it with different words, okay? But I feel the word liberal and liberalism is really worth fighting for because it's one of the great political traditions of our time, and the word says what it means.
What do you think people mean by multiculturalism that you don't believe in then as a word?
I think that multiculturalism has been widely come to mean an actually illiberal policy of you respect my taboo, I'll respect yours. You have your culture, I have mine. You do it your way. You believe in female genital mutilation and forced marriage, and that's your way, and this is mine, and we've no way of judging between them. In other words, of both cultural relativism in theory and of illiberalism in practice. And in Britain, we went too far in this direction, and in particular, in empowering self-appointed community leaders. Particularly the Muslim community, the Hindu community, the Sikh community, and then empowering them to, in a sense, lord it over their own communities. And I think the term multiculturalism has become so compromised by that that I would rather talk about a multicultural version of liberalism or liberalism for a multicultural society. What I won't give up is the fact that we do have a multicultural society. We have cultures and faiths and ethnicities and languages mixed up together as never before, and that's a challenge to us.
In Facts Are Subversive, there are, you know, there's numerous essays where you talk about this. You talk about the tensions of trying to incorporate Islam into an ostensibly secular Europe.
Right.
And you write perfectly rationally and reasonably on those things. And for instance, there's a fantastic essay which is, you know, as unequivocal a defence of Salman Rushdie as you'll find, you know, on the occasion of his knighthood. And yet, for some reason, whenever you read a opinion column, not necessarily just a right-wing paper, but in when you read an opinion column which contains terms like, you know, appeaser or useful idiot, you will see the words Timothy Garton Ash as well. So, yeah. Like, how did this come about? You know, why?
Yeah.
Why on earth is this? What is it about this particular area of argument? And it's a tiny area that so polarises opinion, because, you know, the people that I'm thinking of, as I said, are not the, you know, the nutty Eurabia types, but we're talking about writers like Christopher Hitchens, or most recently in Paul Berman's new book, You're Attacked. And these are writers who I would presume on 9 out of 10 issues, and particularly the multiculturalism issue that you just mentioned, you would be in agreement with.
Yeah. Well, in a way you've got to ask them, because, and in particular Paul Berman, because what he offers is a malicious parody of my position. It bears no relation to my true position, as you can see from the book.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got to ask him why he's setting up this straw man called Timothy Garton Ash. I mean, it's interesting, although extremely irritating, because one of the things it's about is a sort of the rumour multiplier effect of the internet.
Mm-hmm.
That this version gets out there that I and Ian Buruma are these tremendous critics of Ayaan Hirsi Ali and tremendous boosters of Tariq Ramadan, and we think everyone should prefer Tariq Ramadan to Ayaan Hirsi Ali, which is complete poppycock. It's simply, there was no evidence in our writings to support that view. By the way, as if the world wasn't large enough to hold them both. I mean, that in itself, the dichotomy. This is absolutely not. I mean, I stand absolutely on the fundamentals of a secular liberal state, and in that sense on the fundamentals of the Enlightenment. My point is, and here I think there is an important argument, that we have to distinguish between the argument for atheism and the argument for secularism. Mm-hmm. Now, I think Ayaan and everybody else must be free to go out there and argue in the most offensive way possible that God does not exist and therefore Muhammad cannot be his prophet, and it's all a load of nonsense. They must be free to make that case. But this cannot be the demand that a secular liberal state makes of Muslims living in this country. All a secular liberal state can ask of Muslims living in this country is that they should abide by the law and respect the liberal essentials. So that's point number one. Point number two, since it seems somewhat unlikely that 20 million Muslims living in Europe today are all going to become atheists tomorrow, we have to hope that they can reconcile being a Muslim with accepting the liberal essentials of a free society. For that to happen, the so-called Islamic reformers, the people who say Islam as such is not incompatible with a free society, have to be something that we can look to and hope for. And I think many young British Muslims are looking for the Islamic reformers mm-hmm. who tell them you can reconcile the two. So that is my essential point, which is about the importance of finding ways in which people can continue to live in their own self-understanding as devout Muslims in a free society, right? And it is a big ask. I mean, remember, the Catholic Church spent 100 years fighting liberalism. It was only more or less reconciled to it. I'm not sure if the present Pope even today is in Vatican II. It's an even bigger ask of Islam. So you cannot expect Muslim reformers to be perfect secular liberals overnight. That is a totally reasonable and unrealistic expectation. So this is my point. It's about the significance of, as it were, Islamic reform movements in the integration of Muslim communities in Europe.
Rebecca, thanks for talking to Little Atoms today.
Yes, happy to do it.
We're going to be talking about your book, The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks. So, very briefly, first of all, tell us who Henrietta Lacks is and what her significance is to science. Basically, what is the book about?
Right. Henrietta was a poor black tobacco farmer from southern Virginia in the United States, and she was raised on the same plantation where her ancestors were slaves. And in 1951, when she was 30 years old, she was diagnosed with cervical cancer. And by that point, she lived in Baltimore. She went to Johns Hopkins Hospital. And before treating her cancer, without telling her, her doctor just took a little piece of her tumor and put it in a dish and sent that down the hall to George Guy, who was the head of tissue culture research at Hopkins. George Guy had been trying to grow human cells outside of the body for decades, and it would never work. And no one knows exactly why, but Henrietta's cells just never died. They became the first immortal human cells ever grown in culture, which means that they will just keep growing and dividing and living as long as you feed them and keep them warm and clean. And they went on to become one of the most important things that happened to medicine in that era. They were used to develop the polio vaccine. They went up in the first space missions to see what would happen to human cells in zero gravity. Her cells were the first ever cloned. Her genes, some of the first ever mapped. I mean, the list of scientific advances made using them just goes on and on.
And it can't be said often enough, these are cells from one person. I mean, and right. They are now everywhere.
Everywhere, yes. If the scientists out there who have done cell culture, most of them have used her cells, they're in labs all over the world. This happened very quickly, so the cells grew. They, within a few days of her leaving the hospital, they began doubling their numbers every 24 hours. So George Guy just sent them to any scientist who wanted to use them in research, and so they, and those people would give them to their friends, who'd give them to their friends, and so they spread around the world that way, and not long after, a factory was set up in Alabama, where they began mass-producing her cells to the tune of about 6 trillion cells a week, sending those out to laboratories around the world. So the volume of cells that grew from that one tiny sample from this one woman is sort of inconceivable.
We'll look a little later again at some of the things that Henrietta Sells have gone on to do. But first of all, let's talk about how you first heard about her. How did you first become interested in the story?
Yeah, I first learned about the cells when I was 16 years old in a basic biology class. And my teacher said what most biology teachers say at some point, which is, there are these amazing cells. They've been alive since 1951, even though, you know, the woman they came from died. She died just about 7 months after the cells were taken. And, you know, they say these things like there are more of her cells alive today than there ever was of her. I mean, it's this very sort of sci-fi sounding thing, and how important they were for research. And what was unusual is that my teacher knew her name. He wrote Henrietta Lacks in big letters on the board. And at the time, and still to this day, most people think that they came from a woman named Helen Lane, which was a pseudonym put out in the 50s. And so he knew her real name, and he knew that she was Black. And he said those two things, and then that was it, and class was over, and he just sort of moved on. And I went up to him after class, and I was like, well, what else do we know about her, and who was she? Did she have any kids? What do they think about all this? And he just said, that's it, we don't know anything. And so it just stuck at that point, and I sort of became obsessed with the cells, and it never really went away.
So when did you decide to write the book? I mean, let's talk about the beginning of the process, mm-hmm. of actually, because obviously you've written about Henrietta before, yeah. You've had articles published before.
A few articles, yeah. So I started working on the book, it was about 11 years ago, so this was in 1999. And yeah, when I first learned about the cells, I was planning to be a veterinarian. I had no interest in writing. I didn't start writing until I was in my 20s, when I was going to the university. So then I eventually went to graduate school, in where I began to study creative writing, and it was there that I started actually writing about Henrietta. So originally the book was conceived as, you know, you have to write a thesis to graduate. So I was going to write a thesis that was a collection of stories of forgotten women in science. And I imagined that, I think in part because I just couldn't even conceive of writing an entire book about one thing. I mean, this is something like, I was a student, it was very sort of daunting thought. And so I imagined that I would write, that there would be 12 different women, and, you know, I had this plan, and I sort of mapped out, okay, I wrote this piece of paper, and I wrote Forgotten Women in Science at the top, and I numbered 1 through 12, and in number 1 I wrote Henrietta Lacks, and then I just sort of went, I wonder who the other, you know, 11 women will be. So I figured, well, I'll start with her and then see what happens and move on from there. And so I really did imagine that this was going to be one small story about the cells and this woman. And then I began trying to find her family, and I eventually got her daughter Deborah on the phone, which was very hard to do. She was very hard to find. And we had this amazing conversation where she was really excited about the idea of me writing about her mother. She kept saying, well, maybe I'd finally be able to learn what these cells are and what happened. But then she also was just utterly terrified. She mentioned somebody murdering somebody stealing her mother's medical records. And then she at one point said she thought that maybe Johns Hopkins had sent me to steal her cells for research. And then she hung up on me. And I just went, you know, just sort of shocked by the range of things that she said. And really, it was very clear that she had been through something really traumatic with these cells, and I didn't know what it was. But that was the moment where I went, oh, this is much bigger than just one little sort of story. This is an entire book. And so that was really when it all sort of began. And then it would take another year and a half after that to convince her to talk to me again. So she was very resistant.
Hi there. What's your name?
Jonathan Ross.
And what are you doing here at the Amazing Meeting in London?
Well, I'm here because I'm a big fan of Randy, and I'm a big fan of Tam, and I'm a big fan of many of the other speakers here. So, let's face it, I couldn't be anywhere else.
And you're also something of a celebrity in this country, I understand.
I'm well known for some good reasons and some bad. For about how long now? Since 87, I've been presenting TV and radio shows over here. And then a couple of years back, I was involved in a debacle with Russell Brand, which nearly succeeded in bringing down the BBC. Not quite. Better luck next time.
And what got you interested into scepticism?
I think probably my wife initially, because my wife is here as well, Jane Goldman. She writes movies. But before she did that, she was a writer of fiction and non-fiction. And her non-fiction work included two best-selling books based on The X-Files, but looked into the kind of reality or truth, if there was any, behind the many paranormal events that were used on the show. And, you know, fictionalized, obviously. And in the course of that, she got to meet and interview Randy and Susan Blackmore and Wade Davis and many of the people who are obviously well-known to the skeptic community. And that intrigued her and also turned her life around from being someone who was kind of much more on the side of, not only do I want to believe, I'm going to believe regardless, to someone who now says, I can't really believe anymore. So it was kind of a good experience for both of us. And so it's really thanks to her that I'm here, probably.
They're selling the Geek Calendar out on one of the stalls today, and you're one of the people in that. Tell us how you got involved in that.
Well, I knew about the ongoing libel reform case, and I knew about what poor Simon had been through, which is, just sounds about as awful as it, and stressful and unnecessary as something could be, especially when you're just trying to do the right thing. So I was very happy to help, and they just asked me if I'd be in the calendar. Initially disappointed when I found out he wasn't topless or naked, but I swallowed that blow, and I'm sitting at home surrounded by my ridiculous collection of comics and toys, which even I'm embarrassed about the size of, frankly.
It's pretty cool, though, to see somebody who's in the public eye, you know, as much as you are, who retains that geek knowledge, who's a proud, smart person.
But I've always been just really, I've never really been into the mainstream that much, and I don't know whether that's an odd kind of like inverted snobbery, or kind of, you know, an odd sort of geeky vanity perhaps, that you think, oh well, if everyone likes it, it can't be good for me, you know, maybe it's that, because there's a lot of mainstream stuff which I do actually enjoy, but I've always loved comics, and I've always probably preferred weird movies that don't work perhaps, but have a more personal feeling to them than big mainstream stuff. And I, you know, as I said, I love blockbusters, but I'd rather go and see something by Ted V. Michaels or Herschel Gordon Lewis or Ray Dennis Steckler probably than those. So years ago I did the Incredibly Strange Film Show, and that you know, a lot of people knew that was a work of love. And every now and then, when I got the chance on the BBC, and that's probably the one reason why I do feel bad that I'm not there anymore, because sometimes I could exploit my position there to get stuff made that wouldn't otherwise get made. Like, I did a big documentary on Steve Ditko, the comic book artist, and that almost definitely wouldn't have seen the light of day if it wasn't for me. So stuff like that, and I'm hoping still to do more of that kind of thing wherever I wind up.
You're actually working on your own comic at the minute, aren't you? So how is that going? When can we see that?
Look at that, this is so cool, isn't it? I've got a phone coming in on my watch. Hold on one second. Baby, are you going in? Okay, I'm just going to come in. I'm just chatting to some very, very nice podcast people. See you in a minute. Bye, baby. Kind of geeky, isn't it?
It's very geeky.
Yeah,
that's staying in.
Yeah. So what were we saying?
The comic's
going okay, I think. I mean, you know, it's done well critically, and it's sold out as well. Looks like you're wanted on stage. It's up, issue 3 is out next week, and I've finished writing 4, and I'm halfway through 5, and I'm also halfway through my next comic series that I'm writing, and another project I'm doing with another artist. So it's really good, really exciting.
Well, as it's starting then, we'll just quickly finish off. I know it's radio and everything, so they can't see it, but could you explain to us what exactly you're wearing?
I'm wearing an all-in-one black jumpsuit that I bought many years ago, and some Rick Owen high tops, and the jumpsuit is, because I'm feeling a little flu-y today, which maybe I should have told you before we kissed, but it's very comfortable. You know how it is when a man gets to a certain age and a certain weight, and maybe has a slightly kind of like high temperature due to either the change or flu, he doesn't want to wear something too tight around the middle. So this all-in-one, and not only is it comfortable in that respect, also it can vent at the side and see a hint of panty, but you see, you get a little bit of cooling off going on right there, so... And it's handy if a lady wants to reach in and have a rummage, you know? Who am I to say no?
Pretty sure I can sue you for sexual harassment
now. Yeah, I think you can. Yeah, yeah. Your eyes are saying sue, but your hands are saying touch.
Jonathan, thanks for speaking to us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you.
So, Alan, a rationalist mind would be actually an impediment to the sort of imaginative fiction that you write. And I wonder if you did have more of the mindset that would be expected to be in this room, that your work just wouldn't be the work that most of the people in this room know and love?
Well, I'd say that having a rationalist mindset and at least a flimsy working knowledge of science, I mean, I read New Scientist every week, I could probably bluff my way through black holes and a little bit of string theory, stuff like that. I wouldn't really know what I was talking about, but I'd sound credible and plausible. But it's like, I don't know, I think that, yeah, you need to have a good grasp of rationality if you're going to be a good writer. But whether you need something else as well, this was rather the kind of rumination that led me into ruin, or at least intellectual ruin, by suddenly deciding that there might be something beyond rationality. I mean, which there is. There's irrationality. You laugh, but I mean, Douglas Hofstadter, he did a really great interview in his book Metamagical Femurs, and yeah, I've read that, and he was talking about the value of nonsense poetry. He was talking about how we need nonsense, we need irrationality, we need fantasy, if only as the only point from which we can possibly critique reason itself. They've got a value. It transgresses all the laws of our world, and it sees what is outside. And if rationality is a system, then it's got a perimeter fence. Otherwise, it's got to have perimeters or parameters, because otherwise it's meaningless. So if there are parameters, if there is a perimeter to rationality, then we might reasonably ask, what is beyond that? And I tend to think that you can kind of square the circle. You can look at irrationality with a hopefully rational approach, even though it could never be classed as rationality as the term is normally understood. I know that. Yeah, it's like, well, all of this, I mean, yeah, I'm interested in magic. That doesn't mean that I believe, I mean, yeah, I worship a second century snake god. I know it was a puppet. You know, I mean, like the idea of a snake with a human head, long blonde hair, lidded eyes, looks a bit like Paris Hilton, and can apparently speak flawless Greek. I know that that is never going to happen. It's much like, I don't know, virgin birth or kind of ascending physically to heaven. It's just not likely, is it? You know? But the idea is what I'm interested in.
I interviewed Ian Sinclair for the podcast a few weeks ago, and there was some criticism, possibly from someone in the room, on an iTunes review, which basically said this isn't really a skeptical podcast. They were talking to some guff about ley lines or something, and like, you know, Ian Sinclair uses it, and you've used yourself, particularly in From Hell, the sort of psychogeography approach, which, you know, and Ian would look at the city, which is, you know, a city is an engineered rational construct, but he looks at it through the prism of magic, and that's is perfectly a valid approach, it seems to me.
Or if the word magic is one that makes people uncomfortable, I mean, I tend to apply that to any act of creativity, which to me is the same as pulling a rabbit out of a hat. You're pulling an idea out of an empty mind. It's something out of nothing. So you could use the term poetry instead of magic. Poetry is a very useful tool of excavation in that, you know, you walk down the streets that you walk through every day of your life. And if you kind of look at them objectively, it's probably a shit heap. Or perhaps that's just my perspective coming from Northampton, I don't know. But after a while, you're going to internalise that, aren't you? You're going to think, I live in a shit heap. Mm. Therefore, I am probably a shit. You internalise it. You know, you grow up in that kind of neighbourhood, that will seep into your bones. Whereas, if you are able to walk down a street and to see it with a series of overlays, your personal memories, the things that you know about that street's history. I mean, yeah, this does take a bit of excavation down at the library, but it's worth the effort. You find out about the mythological associations that that street might have, the urban legends, because these are all a kind of reality. It's important not to confuse them with material reality, but they were reality in somebody's mind that is literally as fascinating as something out of a fable. Then give it a few years and you might think, actually, I'm kind of fabulous. And I mean, this has clearly worked for me. You know, I can only recommend it to the rest of you wherever you live. Psychogeography is a great tool for making the environments around us mean something.
You've been listening to Little Atoms. You can find details of upcoming guests on our website, littleatoms.com. The Little Atoms podcast is available on iTunes. Thanks for listening.